Woo! We live. Hey, welcome, 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 everybody, to the wall. I know there's, yeah,
we're recording.
So there's some folks that's been in this before, experienced one of these. A lot of y'all that hasn't. Man, this is a cool deal. It's a neat thing to be a part of. This will, if you're new to recovery, new to the steps early on, this will kickstart your understanding and experience with the Big Book. These guys, they light it up. They bring it out. They bring things to life that folks with years and years of recovery don't get to the depths of. These guys bring this information. So I want to thank y'all, Tarek and Brandon, thank you so much. I want to thank the church for having us. Man, we got amazing people at this church. They're serving, going out of their way to be servants for us because they believe in a God too. And they believe that God is powerful and that the way that we stay sober is through the power of God. So whatever that looks like for you doesn't matter. These folks are here to help us. And so please be conscious of the church property, be conscious of your cigarette butts, be conscious of trash, and be helpful. Find a way to be helpful to anybody around you. So I do want to pray. We'll have a couple moments of silence, and I'll pray, and then we'll let these guys get started.
God, grant me serenity
to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Sorry, Brent.
Miscommunication.
Reflex.
I'm going to also pray a personal prayer. Hell yeah. We're trained. That's amazing. God, I invite you into this room. I ask that your presence be felt. I ask that you speak to each and every person in this room, that you give Tarek and Brandon your words, and you allow them to be vessels for the information, for the experience flow through them, that it may reach each and every person in here in the way that they're supposed to experience this thing. I ask that you be with each speaker over the course of the weekend, that they convey a message of hope, they convey a message to the newcomer that says, man, this thing works, because we know that working the steps and getting connected to you through the steps absolutely is a transformational process. So we thank you for the opportunity to be here, the gifts of sobriety, all the people that have played a part in putting this on, the church. We ask that we experience you in every way that you'd have us. Amen.
Amen. My name's Tarek. I'm an alcoholic and a cocaine addict.
Tarek!
It's good to be here. Brandon, Sharif. I don't know if Sharif's in here. But thanks for your role in putting this on. And let's give the ladies in the kitchen another hand. When all y'all automatically went into the serenity prayer, you just got a real-life example of habitual programming. A power greater than myself separated me from alcohol and crack cocaine on the morning of November 5th, 2007. And I played no role in that. I had no intention of coming back to treatment. I had no intention of going to the 12-step rooms. I had no intention of getting clean and sober. I fit several of the descriptions of the alcoholic in the Big Book. I had 17 years of drinking, and I see in my experience that when I drank, most of the time I couldn't control the amount. And I've made a connection that when I got drunk, I ended up in crack houses and trap hotels, so I didn't want to drink anymore, and I kept going back to the first drink. So there's my alcoholism. But when the Big Book says pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, only one substance did that to me, and that was crack cocaine. And I did a lot of heroin and oxycontin and meth, and I smoked DMT, ate a bunch of ecstasy and LSD. But I served one master, and that was crack cocaine, because all the things that I swore I'd never do, I only crossed them off for crack cocaine. So that was the relationship that the great persuader, the big book says great persuader, they're referring to alcohol. In my situation, it's cocaine, but what's behind the great persuader? God. I'm very grateful for crack cocaine. I love crack cocaine. It was a love-hate relationship. But it brought me to the best manner of living I've ever known. I mean, who's brought more people to God than the devil? Right? Mm-hmm. Look at that. Currently, I'm taking 5 men through the steps. They're all at different points in the steps. I have 2 home groups, and I'm active in both home groups, and I attend group conscious on a regular basis. I have a group of men and women around me that literally know everything about me. There is not anything going on in my life that somebody does not know about. They know all of my darkness and what I'm struggling with and where I've had goofy behavior and all of the things that some of us want to hide because we want to walk in the rooms and have everybody think we're doing well when we're not. And it took me 8.5 years to make every approach on an amends, over 200. But I still made an amends this past month. Made a financial amends. And I think it's important to share that with you. I have a very full life. And my commitment to recovery, for whatever reason, has not wavered in 10.5 years. The degree of willingness is not something I can claim. So I'm watching way too many people die. We had a guy, I work in this industry, and I had a guy 2 weeks ago at my program sitting in the office and displaying an enormous amount of what I would call disrespect and just a poor attitude with his family, who's doing what our families have done for years, which is pour extreme amounts of money down a problem and pay for lies, pretty much. That's what they pay for, a bunch of lies, because the truth is in the 12 steps. And very few of these programs were really going to focus on that. And so I said to him, and I can't remember the words. Elric, you may remember them with me. But I told him his attitude was an indicator of like him not being done, right? That he had a very defiant attitude. He had his own plan of how he wanted to do things. And there was nothing you could say to him that was going to deviate him, which to me is a recipe for disaster. That means he's not willing to submit to a way other than his own. And we told him he wasn't a good fit for our program, and he's dead. Right? He walked out with his mom and dad, and she contacted me, what was that, Monday or Tuesday?
Monday night.
And we found him dead last night. She said, thank you so much for trying to help. Please keep our family in your prayers. I wanted to tell her the heroin didn't kill him. That fucking attitude he had in the office is what killed him. You think your battle is with drugs and alcohol, but it's not. And we're going to talk about that this weekend. I want to read something. I don't know where this is going to go, but we'll see what happens. No, because I think this is at the core of the problem. This is by a man named Anthony DeMello. Take a look at the world and see the unhappiness around you and in you. Do you know what causes this unhappiness? You will probably say loneliness or oppression or war or hatred or atheism, and you'll be wrong. There's only one cause of unhappiness, the false beliefs you have in your head. Beliefs so widespread, so commonly held, that it never occurs to you to question them. Because of these false beliefs, you see the world and yourself in a distorted way. Your programming is so strong and the pressure of society so intense that you are literally trapped into perceiving the world in this distorted kind of way. There's no way out because you do not even know or have a suspicion that your perception is distorted, your thinking is wrong, or your beliefs are false. Look around and see if you can find a single genuinely happy person in this room. I think there are a few. Fearless, free, from insecurities, free from anxieties, free from tensions, and free from worries. You would be lucky if you found 1 in 100,000. This should lead you to be suspicious of the programming and the beliefs that you and they hold in common. But you have also been programmed not to suspect, not to doubt, just trust the assumptions that have been put into you by your tradition, your culture, your society, your religion, and your family. And if you are not happy, you've been trained to blame yourself, not your programming, not your cultural and inherited ideas and beliefs. What makes it even worse is the fact that most people are so brainwashed that they don't even realize how unhappy they are, like the man in a dream who has no idea he is dreaming. What are these false beliefs that block you from happiness? Here are some examples. First, you cannot be happy without the things that you are attached to and that you consider so precious. False. There is not a single moment in your life when you do not have everything that you need to be happy. Think of that for a minute. The reason why you are unhappy is because you are focusing on what you do not have rather than what you have right now. Another belief, happiness is in the future. Not true. Right here, right now, you are happy. And you do not know it because your false beliefs and your distorted perceptions have yet got you caught up in fears, anxieties, attachments, conflicts, guilt, and a host of games that you are programmed to play with yourself. If you would see through this, you would realize that you are happy and don't even know it. Here's another belief. Happiness will come if you manage to change the situation you are in or the person or people that are around you. We're going to look at that in inventory. Not true. You stupidly squander so much energy trying to rearrange the world. If changing the world is your vocation in life, go ahead and change it. But do not harbor the illusion that it's going to make you happy. What makes you happy or unhappy is not the world and the people around you, but the thinking in your head. As well search for an eagle's nest on the bed of an ocean as search for happiness in the world outside of you. So if it is happiness that you seek, you can stop wasting your energy trying to cure your baldness, look really good by going to LA Fitness every day, eating that paleo diet or whatever it is to build up that attractive body, or what's that new one, the keto diet? Or change your residence or job or community or lifestyle or even your personality. Do you realize that you could change every one of these things? You could have the finest looks and the most charming personality and the most pleasant of surroundings and still be unhappy. And deep down, you know that this is true, but still you waste your effort and energy trying to get what you know you cannot make you happy. Another false belief. If all your desires are fulfilled, you will be happy. Not true. In fact, it is these very desires and attachments that make you tense, frustrated, nervous, insecure, and fearful. Make a list of all your attachments and desires, and to each of them say these words. Deep down in my heart, I know that even after I have got you, I will not get the happiness I'm looking for. And ponder on the truth of these words. The fulfillment of desire can, at the most, bring flashes of pleasure and excitement. Don't mistake that for happiness. What then is happiness? Very few people know, and no one can tell you, because happiness cannot be described. Can you describe light to people who have been sitting in the darkness all their lives? Can you describe reality as someone in a dream? Understand your darkness and it will vanish. Then you will know what light is. Understand your nightmare for what it is and it will stop. Then you will wake up to reality. Understand your false beliefs and they will drop. Then you will know the taste of happiness. So that young man that sat in the office had a lot of attachments. He had this programming, I don't know where he got it from. If I solve all these other problems, like not being able to spend time with my son, child support, not being able to work and get money, some health issues. If I can solve all these problems, it'll solve the heroin problem. It'll solve the cocaine problem. And that's a delusion. But this industry has exacerbated that delusion. And I think everybody sitting in this room tonight has a desire to be content and happy. Right? But we go, you know, I don't know if you're like me, but I grew up with a belief system. If I was gonna feel something in here, it was gonna take maneuvering some things out here to make that happen. Right? So you're going to hear in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous that this is an inside job. Inside out job. I never truly understood what that meant. And now I do. You know, so I'm a guy that revisits the first 9 steps on a regular basis every year. I do it because it's fun and exciting and I like the effect produced by it. But I also want to do it as a form of submission. Right? I don't want everyone to believe that I've arrived at some point. I want someone to question the things that I believe, right? I want to be able to relax ideas and investigate and have some curiosity and move forward. And I can move forward with the ideas that I brought to the investigation, or I can find some new ideas to believe in. Okay? And one of the ideas I'm going to talk about this weekend is this idea of commitment. And those of you that heard Bill Brown last night, he talked about being convinced. And that's the problem. I bet you 3/4 of this room is not convinced. You know, if you're not willing to submit to a way other than your own, then you're probably not convinced. All right? I'm not going to sugarcoat anything for you this weekend. I'm going to tell you the truth. Another truth is that if statistics are right, less than 10% of this room is going to stay clean and sober. Right. Very few people find their way to these fellowships, get clean and sober, stay clean and sober, and die clean and sober. Look at it when they do countdowns, right? You'll get a bunch of people from year 1 to year 5. You'll get less people to 5 to 10. Then when you get into double digits, it just reduces, reduces, and reduces. And why is that? Commitment. Commitment. So that's one of the things I'm going to talk about this weekend. You know, I used to have a lot of the if-only stories. If only I hadn't been molested when I was 5 years old by my cousin for 2 years. If only my dad had not been an alcoholic. You know, if only my dad wasn't so old. You know, he's a lot older than the other dads. If only my dad went to my basketball games. If only my dad had remembered my birthdays. If only my mom had not abandoned me and left the house for 8 hours at a time, saying she was never coming back because she didn't have the capacity to process what my father was doing, being a violent, physically, verbally, and emotionally. When he was drunk, she would leave these two boys. The two boys would sit by the window and just wait for their mom to come back after she told them she was never coming back. If only that hadn't happened. Those are the reasons I became a crackhead and alcoholic. No, they're not. But my programming sometimes, you know, says that to me. It did for years. You know, there's three views about treating addiction and alcoholism. One view says, all right, let's re-socialize these people into a community of sober people, right? And that's what's going to keep you sober, fellowship-based, right? The second view says, let's uncover that deep underlying trauma that happened to you way back when, and if we can treat that, then you're not going to be an addict anymore. And then the third view is they need to have some type of vital spiritual experience or a personality change to bring about recovery, and they call that a conversion experience. Now, the 12 steps are not the only thing, because if we said the 12 steps was the only thing that generates the conversion experience, we have just now limited the power of the universe. We've limited God. But I know the 12 steps generate it, and I know the 12 steps work, and I know that from my own personal experience. And so I always stress this view when it comes to recovery, but I think it's a magical combination of all three of them. I think it is important to address past traumas. I think it is important to find a strong fellowship of like-minded individuals who are excited about recovery. But I think it's vitally important to go through a process that can generate a conversion experience. You know, the Big Book says that you're not going to like the leveling of the pride, the confession of shortcomings, which this process requires for successful consummation. It also says it's going to require huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions which have been guiding you to this point in your life get thrown aside and a new set of motives and conceptions begin to dominate you. That sounds like some uncomfortable shit. But what's the industry want to do? They want to make you as fucking comfortable as they can. Right? Let's get you into detox, really depressed, psychotic, bipolar symptoms, right? And what do they want to do? They want to make you really comfortable instead of letting you fucking fester in that shit and have it become part of your surrender and part of your first step. And depression is a hell of a motivator for a drug addict and get off your ass and do some work. They don't do that. They just shove a bunch of medication down your throat and tell you, hey, man, let's make you feel really comfortable. And then once you have gotten better, and we'll relax and take it easy and go through this process. Why? Because they fucking live off repeat business. Yeah. And I work in this industry. I'm telling you this. And I have no qualms about it because I've seen it over and over, and it makes me sick. So I'm going to tell you the truth. All right? I'm going to tell you the truth. So, I got into the Grateful Dead and widespread panic. Here's a change, right? Real quick. Around 1995, I got into the Dead, and I got into panic, and I got into Phish, and I discovered something I'd been looking for my entire life, a significant feeling like I was a part of something bigger than me, and I wanted to be free from my mind. And I found at these concerts, with the right combination of drugs and alcohol, nothing would exist except the music. My mind was not in the equation, right? My mind wasn't in the equation. And so, you know, I was able to graduate from college. I had a bunch of decent jobs. I lost all those jobs behind my addiction. 1999, I was 22 years old. That's when I got introduced to cocaine. By 2003, I couldn't snort cocaine. I was selling a lot of cocaine. A buddy comes over to the house. His girlfriend knows how to cook. And so the cook started. And crack cocaine came into the picture, and I entered the dark ages. And for the next 4 years and 9 months, I was almost a daily crack smoker. I had my own brother at one point threaten to kill me because I was buying a lot of cocaine from him and come over to a house with a gun. You know, imagine putting your brother in that situation where he's threatening to kill you. Alright. I burned a lot of relationships to the ground. I had a lot of relationships intact near the end. And I lost job after job, went to treatment, and I was arrested on the evening of November 4th, 2007, with two Schedule 1 felonies down in Florida. One was intent to distribute, another one was trafficking. And that was the, you know, what I just described to you was what I was like in a general way, right? I spent a lot of time, my life was riddled with judgment and fear and demand on people, insecurity, overconfidence, cockiness, but I was terrified of being a productive member in society. That's what my life was riddled with, right? Dishonesty, being a chameleon, I had to be the center of attention. I wanted to be important because if I was important to you, then you'd never leave me abandoned on that window like my mom did, right? She wouldn't leave me if I could just get her to approve of me. That was my first true addiction, was approval. It wasn't any substance. It was approval. We're not people pleasers. Anybody's told you that shit, it's wrong. Ask yourself, let's march everybody in here that's pleased with you right now. How long would that line be? Not very long, huh? They love to tell you we're people pleasers. Fuck that. We are approval seekers. There's a difference. Yeah, we're approval seekers. So I was arrested that night. I sat up all night in jail. I was at the end. I was sitting in the cot in the cell, and I'm going to make a declaration. I'm watching my cussing this weekend. All right, no more, cussing. I sat on the edge of that cell, and it was the morning of November 5th. I hadn't been to bed really since October 29th. And it hit me that it was my new sobriety date, because I've been in and out for the better part of 3 years. And that was Jason's birthday. Now, Jason was that guy who came over with his girlfriend, and girlfriend knew how to cook. He overdosed on my birthday in 2003. They didn't find his body till the next morning. But the information that was delivered to me was, hey, it's your new sobriety day, and it's Jason's birthday, and that's amazing. Like, it was my first sign of something greater than myself lined that up for me as a sign, as a road sign. And for the next 5 weeks, I just had all these I call spiritual experiences. I read these books when I was in jail that reminded me of stuff I heard in the 12-step rooms. And so the indicator was, go to the 12 steps. It's in the last analysis, I knew that was it. I made some phone calls, and my mom, my dad, my brother, and my best friend had said I should stay in jail. And every time I hung up the phone, and I remember it was like there were these two long staircases that came down. There's a phone on each side, big old pod, 72 guys in it. And every time I'd hang up the phone, there'd be a line of guys behind me. It was like reduction to nothingness, like the big book and in the back, the Oxford Group steps, the first one's complete deflation. I was getting deflated every time I hung up the phone. I had no plan and designs. I had no idea. Usually I had someone I was going to be able to manipulate to get out of trouble. But those people were slowly disappearing. Eventually, a buddy of mine, not one of them, got me a lawyer. And I had an arraignment. And this is the turning point for me. This is when I was reduced to completely nothing. They drug me into the courtroom. And my mother, who I had not seen in weeks and didn't know she was there. So my lawyer comes up to me. And I asked my lawyer, I was like, have you seen my mom? He goes, yeah, she's right behind you in the gallery. So as I turned to my mother, I saw this really frail, skinny woman who looked like she hadn't eaten in I don't know how long, and she almost collapsed right there in the courtroom. And something in me broke. I know guys that have had way worse stuff than like that happen to them, and they don't get the surrender I did. I don't know why, but that's what was delivered to me was a surrender. The part of the first step you can't work. It's either there or it's not. And in that moment, the way I had been living became unacceptable. And from a place of unacceptance, you will become willing to do things you've never done before. But all you hear in the room sometimes is acceptance is the answer to all my problems. I think unacceptance is the answer to our major problem. When it becomes unacceptable, you'll do something different. And it became living that way and doing that to people became unacceptable to me in that moment. That's my surrender. That was my turning point. I was reduced to absolutely nothing. What a beautiful place to be. And so I get released and I go to a treatment center again. Except this time, while I was in jail, I was directed back to this guy Dante and this guy Randy. Why, I have no idea. But as a result of that surrender experience in the courtroom, I think as part of my reduction to nothingness, see, everyone sitting in this room right now has a little voice in your head that's lying to you. Right? It's lying to you right now. It's going, this motherfucker with red hair has no... Oh, I just... This guy with red hair has no idea who I am. Who does he think he's talking to? All right. There's somebody in here that already doesn't like me. I'll tell you that right now. And I'm good with that. But the liar of my voice went into remission. And so when I had these imaginative thoughts that said, go to Dante, go to Randy, go back to that Friday night CA meeting where they used to tell the newcomers to shut up and listen and don't share until you have an experience with the 12 steps. And I was like, who do these people think they are? This is group therapy. I need to talk about my problems. Right? They were trying to protect the integrity and the message in their group. And so I was directed back to that meeting. I get to treatment. I tell the treatment center, I got to get to this meeting on Friday night. And it was hard. Nobody wanted to go. Finally, I worked them over, and they took us down to this meeting. And we got there, and it was late. It was raining. The church has an awning in front of it. And so I'm the first one. I jump out of the van. I'm booking it to the church. And the guy I was looking for was standing outside the church on his phone. Nobody else was outside. And I walked back into Randy's life and I said, man, I'm ready. I'll do whatever you want me to do. I don't want to die living this way anymore. And he met with me once a week and he spoon-fed me the program of recovery. And in 5 months, I started sponsoring. And this is where I discovered the missing piece and I connected all the dots. Every other time I'd been to treatment, here's what happens. Day one, I'm very willing. I'm beat up. I don't smell very good. I'm real skinny. I'm willing to listen. And then by day 30, they put some food in my belly. They've got me this little gym membership. I'm going to the gym. I'm going to a meeting almost every day. And I'm not quite as willing as I was on day one. And now you're wrong, and I'm right. All right, this is what starts to happen. By day 60, I've got a job. Okay, maybe not a first paycheck, but by day 90, I got the paycheck. Got money in my pocket. Girl starts talking to me. I'm going to the meeting. I'm practicing all the one-word principles behind all the steps, but I'm not working any steps, okay? Not working any steps. And I think I've arrived. I'm in recovery. And then life throws a curveball, and I require an anesthetic to cope with the curveball, and I'll start smoking pot or drinking beer, maybe pop a couple of Valium. Next thing you know, the vicious cycle has started again. See, what happened in all those years before is I had nothing to connect me with day one. The powerlessness and the devastation, the bewilderment, the despair on day one dissipates. And I can't bring into my mind with sufficient force anything associated with day one. Then life throws the curveball and I have no effective mental defense against what I need, which is an effect. I need an effect to be produced. And so I go through the process. I go over to Hope Homes. I'm sponsoring a guy at Hope Homes. And I sit down. I go into their apartment. We sit down at the dining table in the apartment. I'm sitting across from them, and this kid's got like a week clean. And I got connected to a week. I got connected to a week. And I said to myself, I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to not experience what this kid's going through. I don't want any more of that. And I have done that for 10 and a half years. That's how I stay connected to day one. It completes the circle. The steps are not linear. They're a circle. And my life was catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence. Right? And one aspect of the fourth dimension of existence is your needs are more important than my needs the majority of the time. When you live in the fourth dimension, you want to make sure everyone gets theirs first. That's part of the fourth dimension, in my opinion. And I had this court case going on. And my sponsor, Randy, said to me, listen, man, you need to get, you know, keep repairing the damage you've caused. Work these steps. Show other men how to work the steps, and you'll be okay with whatever happens. Because my lawyer said I was going to prison for 3 years. Yeah, that's the deal he was trying to get me, was 3 years in prison. Work camp, maybe get out in 18 months. And so, that was really difficult to deal with. And I started documenting my recovery, got back into school. I was working two jobs. I've been hired at the treatment center as a clinical assistant. And I documented all of it, every drug screen I passed. And 9 months to the day, August 5th, 2008, I get a phone call. My lawyer had filed a motion to suppress evidence, and I just sent him everything I've been collecting. And he met with the assistant district attorney, and he was going to file the motion. And for whatever reason, this is the miracle, right? Something you cannot explain happens in your life. That's a miracle. The district attorney dropped all the charges. I didn't get any community service. I didn't get any probation. There's nothing on my record. It didn't make any sense to me. And all I could think about when I was standing in my kitchen is the forward to the first edition says, after reading these pages, we hope no further authentication will be necessary. And then for me, no further authentication was necessary. I made a commitment to do the work and live the life described in this big book to whatever capacity on whatever day that God gives me. And that's what I've done. That is my commitment. That's it. I'm committed. You know, I have virtually lost a marriage because of my commitment to recovery. Okay. Because I'm the one who has to live with myself when I start smoking crack. Nobody else does. Eventually they can all walk away. So I wanted to share my experience of how I ended up here tonight. I didn't have any choice in being here tonight. I would venture to have you guys consider you didn't have any choice. For whatever reason on your journey, you're supposed to be here tonight. Some of you are here to listen. Some of you aren't. It's okay. I would encourage you to get outside of yourself this weekend and meet some people you don't know. I see how you guys are so clickish. I know some of you are required to be here. Some of you are not required to be here. And we love that you're here. And we're going to have some fun with it this weekend. We're going to make you uncomfortable. We're going to piss you off. At least your mind's going to tell you that. But our intent here is to excite some of you about the program of recovery. That's our intent this weekend. So, all right. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks, Gary.
We buried him yesterday. The county coroner had published the required notices for the next of kin, and no one claimed the body. It was just myself and his sponsor. Not even a preacher. The county doesn't pay for those. Not much of a send-off, not the one that David had asked for. a cheap coffin, a backhoe digging a hole. That was it. Another old AA gone. He had been sober 20 years and an AA over 30. A stern and rigid man who tried to soften his edges and never could. He was a loner, an isolated man at the edge of life's good things. He hung in there and in the end hung himself. I don't know why, I can't know. I know there had been the diagnosis of senile dementia. And I know that the doctor had added cancer to the list. But I've seen AA's deal with such things before. I don't know why David decided that he couldn't. It isn't the first time I've been through this in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've known several over the years who just up and walked out of life's door one day. Sober but not happy. Sober but not at peace. Sober, but they died of alcoholism. Our disease does not need us to drink in order to kill us. I wish more folks knew that and appreciated it. Alcoholism and drug addiction are the only diseases that are capable of fighting back, taking care of themselves, and of emerging in new places and in new forms when it isn't properly treated. That's because of the spiritual malady. Most people think it has something to do with prayer or God. It doesn't. It has to do with our spirit, the force which animates, motivates, and propels us. As an alcoholic or addict, my spirit is flawed. My character or basic nature doesn't work right. At its root is a fundamental and irresolvable insecurity, a hole that can't ever be filled. It is an instinct run rampant and in desperate need of acceptance and love that cannot be met. It hurts. It fills one with fear. The selfishness and self-centeredness of the alcoholic and addicts lies here. We are totally preoccupied with what's going on in ourselves on the inside. The slings and arrows of experience warped by the need drives us to the fringe, and the voices of the committee in our head keeps us there. We are obsessed with ourselves, and from this condition of mind, the insanity of feeling gone haywire, we become self-medicators eventually. We discover alcohol or something else, and this quiets the voices and provides the relief we've never been able to find in any other way. It isn't any wonder why we drink or drug the way we do. And some of us don't develop an addiction. In attempting to meet our crying demand of our spirit, we become ill. We develop other malformations of behavior and suffer 100 different ways. God broke David's obsession to drink. I watched him, but I don't think David ever truly understood his disease. I say that because I watched him struggle over the years with unresolved issues in his heart. His rigidity, coldness, aloofness, isolation, and difficulty with other people are a reflection of the pain in his heart, of the disease of alcoholism gone deep inside and still alive. Alcoholism didn't need David to drink in order to continue to try to kill him. And in the end, it succeeded. In the end, instead of self-abandon, David abandoned hope and discovered a bitter end. Our recovery from alcoholism through the steps must be a threefold process. It is not one-dimensional. When we say in AA we have a triangle, recovery, unity, and service, we mean it. Working the steps, a clear pathway for two purposes. First, to come into a group of human people away from the fringe of society where I've spent most of my emotional life. Secondly, discover belonging through service to other people within the group. It is only this entire threefold process that heals. It is especially true of those who suffer from a spiritual malady to a great degree. Perhaps the 12th step says it best. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, recovery, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and addicts, service, and to practice these principles in all our affairs, unity. You see, I cannot hold back. I must continue to suffer that shyness, aloneness, and overwhelming sense of self in my affairs. I must get involved in a group of people to practice these principles in all my affairs. Only the total approach is healing. Anything less is a little more than driving my disease deep. And if I do that, it will continue to eat away, trying to destroy me. It destroyed David. This is a memorial to an old AA who gave it his best shot. And I think David ended up on the plus side. It wasn't his fault. He seemed to have been born that way. There were a lot of old ideas about self that David could never muster the willingness to let go of. He is at rest now, but it says somewhere, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. David cannot speak to his experience any longer. I am speaking in his memory. I think if David could talk to us today, he would say, understand your disease thoroughly and work the complete program of recovery. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Brandon.
Hey, Brandon. Hey, Brandon.
I identify as an alcoholic. And apparently I'm good cop this week. Faith is a mental attitude that is so convinced of its own idea, which so completely accepts it, that any contradiction is unthinkable and impossible. I've been on this path my entire life, but I've been on the sober path since June 15th, 2011. I didn't plan on it. I didn't particularly want to be here. I didn't really know that there was any other way than the way that I had been living. But I was forced to accept a different way, not by choice, but by circumstance. It's fascinating to me when I look at my life today and when I actually apply the steps in my life, what happens. So I'm going to share a current, real, actual thing that happened to me this afternoon. So I started on Tuesday morning and I drove to 26 different cities. And I didn't check my odometer, but I think I covered somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 miles to get here today. Not everything went as planned, but it was pretty close to as planned. But I ended up having to stay away one day longer than I expected. I wanted to get home late last night, but I didn't get home until 2:30 today in the afternoon. And I've got a wife that I love more than I would think it was possible to love a woman. And I had just enough time to go home, spend an hour with her, put the coolers in my truck, head down here, and get ready for this thing. So I expected a parade when I got home because I was working so hard to grace her with my presence for an hour before spending the entire weekend with a bunch of derelicts like you guys. And what was really weird is she didn't throw a parade. And she hardly got up from her desk. And I didn't really cop a resentment, but I got very confused as to why such a thing would happen. And so after kind of being in the room with her for about 30 minutes, she said, oh, can you try to see if you can get this thing on the TV to work so I can watch Hulu and whatever. And so I went out there and worked on that. She said, how long until you have to leave? And I said, 20 minutes. She said, okay, I'll be out in just a minute. And 10 minutes later, she comes into the room where I am trying to do something for her. And by then it's time for me to put the coolers in the truck and kind of start gathering things and head on my way. Now, we said goodbye, but from the time I left the house to the 45 minutes to the exit, I was kind of playing with this in my head. Where was the parade? Should have been something there, right? And so I wasn't totally disturbed, but I was off. And so as I was sitting at the light at the exit, I was like, I'm gonna 10-step this with terror. Called another buddy, but he was busy. And, And as I'm sitting there, I was like, you know, the 10th step says we watch, right? So I identified I was troubled. And the next instruction is we ask God to remove it. And then the third part of that is we discuss it with someone immediately. Well, I was going to discuss it with Tarek when I got here, but I realized I had missed something. I forgot to ask God to remove it. And because we do the things that we do, I knew that one of the first questions he was going to ask me was, well, when you prayed to have it removed, what happened? And sometimes I like to lie there and say, well, you know, nothing really happened. But in this case, I was like, no, I'm going to do it. So I'm sitting there at the stoplight, and I go, all right, God, I'm kind of done with this thing. Can you just make it go away? And because I like to test the power of God, I fired off, she wasn't real excited to see you. And the immediate response that came in my head was, who cares? So I asked God to remove it, and guess what happened? Gone. Immediately. To the point when I got here, I did discuss it, but I told him it wasn't bothering me anymore, and I was over it. Practical program of action. That's what we're going to talk about this weekend. Little things like that. Now, I said apparently I'm the good cop this weekend because we put on one of these, I don't remember which one it was, we were at the Bridges, and I was cussing a little more, and I was a little more in your face. And about halfway through, Tarek said, I just figured something out. And I said, what's that? And he goes, you're much more abrasive than you usually are. I was like, huh, really? And he's like, yeah. And I said, sat there for a second, and I said, is that a problem? And he goes, I kind of like you the other way. And so I sat there for a minute, and I was like, do you like me the other way? Because if I'm good cop, that means that you can be more harsh. And he said, well, yeah. And so the way you started off, I thought, well, maybe I'm going to be bad cop this weekend. But then like something turned in the middle there. I'm like, I'm good cop. We really mostly have no idea what we're going to talk about. We have an outline of things that we generally go through. We have some ideas, but I mean, the reality is, guys, we don't know what you guys need. Your spirit will speak to us in different ways, sometimes through your words, sometimes through whether or not you're paying attention, sometimes by putting your head down and your face in your hands and maybe taking a nap. But whatever you're doing, you're telling us. You're telling us what's going on. We see it when you get disturbed. And what's fascinating, too, is we can be up here, and there'll be a guy somewhere in here that has been paying zero attention the entire weekend, and somewhere around the last day, he'll send up like this little energy flare where it's like... And I'm not kidding, we see it. It's fascinating. It's like, did you see that? I just started paying attention. He paid no attention all weekend long, and now he's paying attention. Because something in us touched something in that guy that made him start getting engaged. So it's a lot easier if you come up and say, hey, I have a question about this, or are you going to talk about that? Because then we don't have to interpret what the flare was, or what the sleeping or paying attention is about. You can just tell us. And then we can apply some of our experience to whatever it is that you're asking us. And then we can have this little interactive thing. And then you get a completely different experience that's just for you. Because we don't know who we're talking to in here. There's somebody in here. Their life will change as a result of this weekend, and the reason why we know that to be truth is because we've seen it happen. We did the first one of these at the Bridges 2 or 3 years ago?
2016.
Okay. And there's a pocket of enthusiasm that came out of the Bridges that said that when you guys came and presented the steps the way that you did, it made more sense to me than anything I've ever been through. Their words, not mine. And those guys, a lot of those guys are still sober, a good number of them. And it's fun to watch because we see them working with their sponsees and saying things. And that has nothing to do with Tarek or I. It has to do with the experience that was brought to us that we took to them that they now are transmitting to somebody else. Who in here at some point in your life wanted to be somebody special and do something important with your life? That's it? Missing a couple. Maybe they weren't paying attention. Okay. Who in here has wanted to understand it all and have a connection with something that gave them all the answers?
Yeah.
Who in here wishes that they had a way when they were disturbed to go through a little process to where it fixes it to where they can go on with their day? Who in here wants to be able to answer that phone number that they don't know who it is calling, but they don't want to answer it because it might be somebody that needs something from them, is looking for a payment on something, or somebody that's just coming after them? Yeah? Who would like to kind of like be able to take all of what's wrong with them and have a magical way of just letting it go? Who would like to know the truth about themselves in a way that all the things that they thought about themselves that weren't true are suddenly cast aside and they can really be the true them? Anyone? We were at a meeting on Monday, and page 164 it says, though you be but one man with a book in your hand, or woman, and the thought hit me when we read that you want to change the world, change yourself. And I looked around the room, and sitting in that meeting, there were 10 guys that I had taken through the steps. 10. And of the people that they had taken through the steps, there were probably 4 or 5. I don't know exactly who all they're sponsoring. But then if I take it up a notch to my sponsor and look at the people in the room that he sponsored, at least 25% of the room was sober as a result of Tarek getting sober. Think about all the wreckage that drug addicts and alcoholics cause in the world. And if we could just pluck 25% of those people out of it, would the world be a better place? Yeah. Because effectively, that's what Tarek's done. And then to have a weekend like this where the people that put it on knowingly come here and put it on for the benefit of you guys. And just so it's real clear, what could Brandon be doing other than being here? Okay. Well, I got 4 kids. I have 10 goats, 3 that are pregnant. I have 9 baby hogs, a mommy and a daddy hog, and I think 26 chickens. I'm not really sure. Chicken math is kind of funny. They just kind of show up, right? 2 weeks from now, we're going to go get a breeding pair of emus. And I've got a shit ton of fencing that I got to put up. I got some structures I got to build. And I spent the entire week away. And I got a wife that really likes spending time with me. Unlike the one at the end that I had before. That she didn't want to spend any time with me. And I could be doing that. Any of that. Anything other than this. But there's no place I would rather be than right here, right now. So it's fun when I look around and see that other people might be having a little bit of fun, because if you're not, then I feel like I should go do something else. So I ask that you try to be as interactive as you can. I ask that you try to pay attention. I ask that you don't take notes of what we say, but take notes of what your experience is with what we say. Notice what's going on inside you. If we say something and you say these guys are full of it, write it down. Challenge us. Question us. See, because I'm a guy that I thought I had it all figured out. Somewhere along the line, either through watching a James Bond movie or something like that, I came up with this concept of nobody knew who I was, I would be kind of mysterious. Which would therefore make me maybe interesting. Okay? And so I systematically went through my life not letting anybody know who I was. Even the woman I was married to, she didn't even get the full story. So she would compare stories with other people and be like, this doesn't make sense. That's the guy I'm married to. And so I neatly constructed this little wall around me to where nobody could come in. And I was safe. And I didn't start drinking until I got in college, but when I started drinking, it was like, I don't care anymore what anybody thinks. And I was not a social drinker. I was not a guy that drank because everybody else was drinking. I drank to get messed up. That's it. That's it. That was the only purpose of drinking. And if I couldn't get messed up, I didn't drink. Go over to somebody's house, there's 10 people there, and they got a case of beer, I'll wait. You buy me a case of beer, maybe we can hang out for a little while. And so it didn't progress that way to where it was a problem for a while. I was often asked, what's wrong with you? I was often told of the incredible potential that I had in my life that I seemingly couldn't live up to. Everybody I ever worked for was a freaking idiot. Because I knew how to run their business better than they knew how to run it. They just need to ask me and really appreciate me for who I was. And then what I'll tell you what that looks like is 8 jobs in 7 years. And they were all idiots because they didn't know what they got rid of. Right? Poor guys. Wife that was constantly threatening to leave. Constantly trying different tactics to get me to get my shit together. And none of it worked. None of it worked. And living in that self-constructed prison for so long, it became so lonely that I finally got to the place where I didn't want to be here anymore. And so there was a particular night where I sat outside the room where I kept the pistol, wondering why I couldn't go in and just go ahead and do it. And before that moment, there was always some other reason to keep me here. The kids, the family, the judgment of others, what you guys would say about me. Would anybody really show up at the funeral? I didn't care anymore. This night I didn't care. But yet a force field had been put in front of the door where I couldn't go in. And what ended up happening is I didn't go in the room and shoot myself in the face, but I did take my kids to a neighbor's house and then drive an hour away to my parents' house, couldn't get into their house, and ended up passing out on their back patio. Had my dog with me because I was afraid that, even though sanity seemed to be coming back in a little bit, I was afraid that maybe I would just yank the car off the road on the way to my parents' house. But I knew if the dog was with me that I wouldn't hurt her, so I was going to keep her to keep me safe. Couldn't get in the house, made a little patio, on the patio, made a little bed of patio cushions and towels, and we fell asleep and woke up the next morning realizing that the error of my plan was my dad, as he's bumping me with his foot, wondering why the hell I'm asleep on his back patio. As I came to, it occurred to me that I had not come up with a good excuse yet. Always had a story. Always had, like, my stories were so planned. like, flawless. Should have been a bank robber or a criminal of some kind, because you wouldn't have ever been able to figure out what I did. But this morning, I had to ask him to go inside so I could make the story up. And as I sat there that morning, this is the way I describe it, and it doesn't do it justice. The air was crisper, the birds were louder, and the sun was brighter. And something in me shifted because I realized what had almost happened the night before. And it sobered me up for 4 days. 4 days later, I was right back at it. Within 2 weeks, on an island with no bridge off the coast of South Carolina, the woman I was married to, the mother of my children, announced to me and to her parents at the same time that she no longer wanted to be married to me. Apparently, she had been thinking about this. Nobody else knew. It was a big shock. And this time, she was serious. I could tell. There was something different in the energy in her that she was done. And something shifted in me. That realization of, ooh, maybe we overdid it this time. And the next morning, it was proposed to me by my mother-in-law. She asked, do you think you could go the rest of your life, not one day at a time, the rest of your life without drinking? And the answer I gave was yes, except for weddings and funeral. And then there was the incessant list that continued to tally in my head. And football games, and kayak trips, and sunny days, and rainy days, days at the beach, days at the pool, Tuesdays. Lighting the grill. Oh my God, I remember the first time I lit the grill without a beer. Didn't know it was possible. Apparently it lights by itself without my beer in my hand. And that opened me up to this experience of, why are there so many reasons why I drink? And then grace opened up for me and things started to shift and things happened in my life. That the desire for me to go back to the way that I used to live no longer existed. If you're sitting in this room and you've not had the experience that Tarek had, where he was ripped wide open by seeing his mom, or all fight in you is just gone, you might be done, but you're probably not. If you still have a third option on the table, new job, new girlfriend, different place to live, marijuana maintenance program, better antidepressants, better group of friends, there's still something on the table for you, probably not done. And I know that it's a lot of people try to convince you that you the desire from within can be enough to get you to stop? Probably not. Because if it was up to me, it probably would have happened 2 or 3 years earlier when I woke up that morning in the bathroom after ripping the towel bar off the ground, off the wall, and having the most miserable day, and actually looking up AA meetings, but not going because I wasn't ready. I think that one of the worst things that happens in society today is this idea that we want you here. Welcome. Please, we'll love you till you can love yourself. Kills more people than anything else out there. We want you when you're ready to be here. Now, if you haven't had that experience, hang with us for the weekend, because you might intellectually get there over the course of the weekend, and the seeds might be planted to where you start to question whether or not you're really done. Good. Let's have some conversations about it. Let's have some conversations about what is a type 1 alcoholic, type 1 addict versus a type 4. Let's have some conversations about what is the allergy really doing to me? What is the mental obsession? What's the spiritual malady? What do these things fire off in me? Is it possible life could be more fun? Come spend some time with us.
We're going to take a break, but before that, I would invite each individual sitting in this room to get up, walk over to two people you do not know, introduce yourself, and give them a hug. Please, come back in 15 minutes. Woo!